coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The holiday shopping season is upon us, but like everything else, it will be different in 2020 because of COVID-19.
Half of shoppers, 51%, will buy most of their gifts online just because they want to reduce their COVID risk.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida joins us to talk about just how different this holiday shopping season will be. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also take a closer look at the remaining portion of the state education funding lawsuit that's now headed to trial this spring. Arts Playlist has more on the latest exhibition at the Historic Odessa Foundation. And Enlighten Me explores the impact Joe Biden's post-election events on Wilmington's riverfront may have there. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It appears the second prong of the two-prong lawsuit challenging Delaware's education funding system will see a trial early next year. A month after the portion focused on the state and its funding methods was settled, a March trial date is set now for the portion focused on the county and its property tax system. That system was ruled unconstitutional earlier this year by Chancery Court Vice Chancellor Travis Laster, but he deferred imposing a remedy. And that's what will be at issue in the trial after no settlement was reached in the case. Contributor Larry Nagengast has been following the school funding lawsuit from the beginning, and this week takes a closer look at where things stand in this part of the case and what's really at stake in this trial. His piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss it. So before we dig in, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of why this is heading to trial? Why no settlement here? Where do we stand?
Well, okay. Even a thumbnail is not particularly brief, but let's go back to the beginning and take our way through this. Early in 2018, two groups, the Delawareans for Educational Opportunity and the NAACP Delaware State Conference, filed a suit in the Court of Chancery challenging the state school funding system, claiming that the system was not equitable because it diminished opportunities for students in three groups: low-income students, English language learners, and special needs children in kindergarten through third grade. Vice Chancellor J. Travis Laster eventually divided the suit into two tracks, a state track and a county track. Now, the state track, which deals with the complex system the state uses to allocate funds to public schools, was resolved through mediation last month. In brief, Governor Carney has agreed to add about $130 million to state education funding over the next 4 years to benefit students in those three groups that I just mentioned. Now, the General Assembly still has to approve that funding, but assuming that happens, that part of the case is done. Now, on to the county track. The vice chancellor looked at these outdated systems that the counties use to assess real estate. It's outdated because the last assessments occurred in Kent County in 1987, in Newcastle County in 1983, and in Sussex County all the way back in 1974. That was when Richard Nixon was president. The vice chancellor ruled in May that this system violates both state law and the state constitution. Now, in October, lawyers for the counties and the plaintiffs tried to negotiate a settlement, but they told the judge last week that they were unable to make a deal. And so on Monday, the judge issued an order setting a trial date for the end of March.
And while reassessment, Larry, is most certainly going to be part of any final resolution of this case, your piece indicates that some believe that may not ultimately have the impact sought to solve the inequities in education funding that the plaintiffs have brought up. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. You're correct about a reassessment being an essential part of the resolution. Both sides agree that the only way to fix a system that's out of balance is to start all over again, using the same set of standards, the same time frame for setting property values, and presumably doing it statewide. But here's the rub. A reassessment is going to iron out differences in property values across the area that where the process occurs, but it's not going to change the fact that homes in rural agricultural areas are worth less than those that are at the beach, that a 100-year-old row house on the east side of Wilmington is worth less than a mansion in Greenville. But you know, a reassessment will fix some variations that have occurred over time, as some areas have become more popular to live in and others less popular since since the last reassessments, and those differences would be fixed and made more equitable. However, I asked Ed Ratledge, who's a University of Delaware expert who has done research on property values for about 40 years, about this issue, and he told me that reassessment will do nothing at all to fix the inequities that impact certain groups of students. It's going to correct a different sort of inequity. You know, if Mr. Smith is paying too much in property taxes and Mrs. Jones is paying too little because of these inconsistencies in the assessments. But it's got nothing at all to do with whether school districts spend enough of the tax dollars that they collect on the kids who have the greatest needs.
And before we'll ever get to see what impact reassessment may or may not have, the battle we're likely to see play out in court is over how it's going to happen. And let's try to take that piece by piece, starting with when would it happen and how long would it take? What's the path forward look like with that piece of the puzzle?
Okay. While it's still possible that the plaintiffs and the counties could negotiate a settlement before the end of March, let's assume that that won't happen. That would put the judge on track for issuing a decision sometime in April and, in all probability, ordering the counties to start the reassessment process. The counties have already given the judge reports from their consultant detailing reassessment procedures, and those reports show a process that would stretch out over about 38 months. So if the counties got the ball rolling on reassessment by requesting proposals from vendors next July, it would be late 2024 before the work is completed, meaning that the earliest the taxpayers would be affected by a change in property values and tax rates would be on the tax bills that they would receive in the summer of 2025.
So that is a long way out. And even more contentious an issue is who's going to pay to go through that whole to have this all done, to have this process completed. The assumption is that that rests with the counties. That's why this is called the county track of the lawsuit. But they're signaling that they want the state to get involved. Why not the counties? Aren't they the ones who are kind of guilty of kicking this can down the road for decades, as you noted, in terms of the lag in reassessments?
Well, yes. State law says that the counties have to pay for reassessments. And yes, they have indeed kicked that can down the road for decades, which means that they actually have had plenty of time to set aside money to pay for it. But they haven't. And reassessments aren't cheap. Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer has said from time to time that reassessment in Newcastle County could cost somewhere between $15 million and $27 million. So you can understand why the counties would want someone else to pay, I mean, even if it's their legal obligation right now, and especially if reassessment is the solution to what is considered a statewide problem.
So how about the school districts? They're the ones who get the tax dollars. Do they have any role here? Should they?
Well, here that's where it gets really interesting. You know, the county governments actually serve as the tax collector for the school districts. The school tax is included on the county tax bill, and when the taxes are paid, the school portion gets funneled over to the districts. Now, more importantly, school tax bills are higher than county tax bills, which means that the counties would be paying for a reassessment while the schools would be getting most of the benefit of the equalization or more equitable value here. Now, look, in Sussex County, for instance, about 90% of the property tax money that is collected goes for school taxes. Now, I checked my latest Newcastle County school tax bill this week, and school taxes accounted for nearly 75% of the total. So the problem here is that the school districts don't have a revenue stream that they could use to pay for a reassessment. In essence, they'd have to have a referendum to raise funds to pay for it. And well, you know, you can do the math. You know, if you've got fingers on one hand to figure out how many taxpayers are going to vote for that. Now, technically, however, local school districts are agencies of the state, and that's why the counties are hinting that the state should pick up, you know, if not all the tab, some of the tab here.
So now that we have kind of an argument for state involvement, if the state does get involved, what could that look like? Are there some benefits to doing it that way?
Okay, well, let's tick off what some people would say are the benefits. Now, say you do a statewide reassessment and you get uniform administration of the assessment procedure. You get a uniform set of data. You get everybody following the same standards. You know, and so with one state office that would be in charge of the reassessment, everything's going to get done the same way. Now, that's not necessarily going to happen if you had each county operating on its own. Now, having a central database run by the state would make it easier to update assessments in the future on a regular basis, so the counties couldn't kick the can down the road again and again. It would also resolve some of the confusion that occurs in those school districts that cross the county line. Some are split between Kent and Sussex. Some are split between Kent and Newcastle. So as a result, in these situations, there are different tax rates in these districts depending upon which side of the county line you live on. In addition to that, other state agencies like the Department of Transportation, the Natural Resources and Environment Control, and the Delaware Emergency Management Agency, sometimes they need property data, and having a central database would be helpful to them as well. Now, still to be determined is the payment issue. Would the state agree? Could it be forced to pay? How would that be done? Well, right now, the state isn't part of this lawsuit's county track, and state law does make counties responsible for reassessment, so it's hard to see how the judge could make the state put the bill. And that's why the counties are still hoping that they can find a way to persuade the state to pick up the tab, or at least some of it. Now, Ed Ratledge, the assessment expert at UD, did offer an interesting concept. Say the state issues a bond to cover the cost of reassessment and then figures out a formula that might add a couple of pennies to the tax rates for the counties and the school districts so that they could pay off the bond over a period of years. Now, that might be worth considering, but that's also something that the General Assembly would have to do, and they're already looking at having to fund that extra spending that the governor promised in the settlement to the state track. So, you know, none of this is really simple.
And, of course, there's also the question of what kind of revenue will the state have in the next year plus as we continue to deal with this pandemic. So let's finish up here. You know, how much of an issue is it that this is going to go to trial, that there hasn't been a settlement, that the process isn't really moving forward? Is this really going to kind of push back real progress, both in terms of reassessment and in terms of a better state funding system?
As I mentioned earlier, it looks as though having a trial will push back the start of any reassessment process by about 6 months. Now, if the General Assembly gets involved in the discussion of who pays, that creates a couple of scenarios. As you know, the General Assembly session starts in January and ends on June 30th. So if the General Assembly gets involved and agrees to some form of state payment and does so by the end of March, when the trial is scheduled to start, well, that's about the same as if the trial goes forward. Now, if the General Assembly gets involved but doesn't decide anything by the end of March, well, the judge could let negotiations continue to as late as June 30th, when the session would end, and that would delay the start of reassessment even further. But, you know, the judge has made clear that he's not happy with all the delays that have happened so far. So I really don't see that happening. So we've got a lot of ifs here and not as many answers. So I suspect that I'm going to be back again when we've got something more to talk about.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the county prong of the Delaware school funding lawsuit is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at how different this year's holiday shopping season will be thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Thanksgiving is just days away, and with it, the start of the holiday shopping season. But this is likely to be a holiday shopping season unlike any other, as retailers and consumers try to navigate the coronavirus pandemic that has worsened in recent weeks, both locally and across the nation. Each year, we turn to contributor Eileen Dalabrida to give us a preview of what to expect during holiday shopping. Her reporting on this year's expectations and trends is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to talk about what she learned. So let's start with the obvious question. With the COVID-19 pandemic worsening, is the emphasis across the board at this juncture online shopping this year? Is that where we expect most of the action to come?
Well, there's a great survey that's out by the NPD Group that says that half of shoppers, 51%, will buy most of their gifts online just because they want to reduce their COVID risk. People are also shopping earlier, which is a good idea on several fronts. We've all lived through toilet paper shortages and back orders on building supplies, and we know that there may be glitches in the supply chain. And spreading out trips to the store should help to reduce the crowds, at least in theory. Plus, we can also expect to spend less, partly because we aren't hosting parties or big holiday dinners or buying fancy clothes.
You mentioned spending less. What are the retailers' expectations for this year with more online shopping and the pandemic limiting what people may actually even need?
Well, department stores in particular are expected to struggle. We're still seeing that haves and have-nots, and the big box discounters like Walmart and Target and Costco will continue to thrive. We're also seeing just fewer places to shop, with stores like Sears and Pier 1 and Stein Mart out of the picture, and that could benefit the retail survivors.
We've also talked a lot in recent years about many stores, you know, kind of starting Black Friday on Thanksgiving, opening up on Thanksgiving for shopping. It appears that's kind of a no-no this year, right?
Well, there will be way less Thanksgiving Day shopping, and that's reversing a trend that had gathered a lot of steam in recent years. Walmart, Kohl's, Target, Old Navy, and Macy's, all of which were open on Thanksgiving Day previously, will be closed. The only stores that you can really expect to see open are drugstores, grocery stores, and dollar stores. So instead of seeing these big Black Friday doorbusters, we're seeing multi-day sales. Dick's, the big box sporting goods store, is offering its Black Friday deals over a 10-day period, which started on November 18th. There's no reason to camp outside a store with hundreds of other shoppers to dash in and get that deal. They're already available, and they will be available through Black Friday and perhaps after.
Let's talk a little bit about small businesses. And we heard state officials here in Delaware say last week, hey, be careful about going out and holiday shopping, but also touting, hey, shop local at small stores and shops here in Delaware, help them out. Is there any sense of the expectations for small businesses and how important is this season to their survival?
Well, many of the small independent retailers are doing a super good job of weathering the storm. They're leveraging their longtime relationships with their regular customers, and they're becoming more tech savvy and doing things like shopping by appointment. Some of the local indies have closed their storefronts, and they have already made the shift to online during the first wave of the pandemic. So they're actually in a good position for a holiday shopping season in which more people are expected to shop virtually.
But bottom line is that they do need to have a good holiday season if they want to kind of offset some of the difficulties they had earlier this year.
They truly do. They need that. They might not have the big properties that the chains have to maintain. They might not have as large a staff, but they are integral to the community, and they're really depending on the holiday.
One trend we talked about last year was a move away from buying things, buying stuff, and moving toward buying experiential type things, places to go, tickets or things like that. I would assume that that's also something that's very much on hold this year because you just can't go and do things like you used to.
Yes. Travel especially is way down. This year we're nesting. And instead of flying to Hawaii to see volcanoes, we're buying fire pits so we can stay outdoors as long as possible. That said, there are still ways to support your favorite local restaurants and salons and spas by buying gift cards for people to use in better times.
Are there some other trends that we're seeing as we head into this holiday shopping season, things that are a little bit different from years past, or things that are still kind of holding up despite the pandemic?
Well, we're queuing at the curb. Last year, curbside pickup was such an outlier that market watchers didn't even keep statistics. This year, 1 in 4 customers plans to order holiday purchases online and pick them up curbside. It's a biggie. We're also clicking ahead to avoid the crowds. You can go to Target's website, for example, and see if there are long lines at your store. And if there are, you can just go another time. Tanger Outlets in Rehoboth Beach is introducing live stream shopping, and that's an interactive platform in which shoppers, you can use your mobile devices to see the actual products in the actual stores in real time, presented by real people, so that you can get a pretty good idea of if you want to buy something and really reduce your browsing time. And we're also seeing outdoor shopping. Christchurch in Greenville has a very popular annual green show. This year they've moved it outdoors. They reserve the first hour of the sale for people who are elderly or have compromised immune systems. The Poplar Hall Artisans Market, that's going to be open air in Chesapeake City.
And you always tell us a little bit about deals. You mentioned earlier that there are going to be deals this year. They may not be one-day deals. Are there some ones that really stand out that people can look for as they start their holiday shopping?
There are lots of great deals. Unemployment is still high, and a second stimulus check is up in the air. So retailers are rolling out the deals. Best Buy is looking out for people who are feathering their nests. And they are offering a Samsung gas convection range for $700, marked down $400. Macy's has Martha Stewart's diamond tufted velvet quilt. It's usually $143. Now it will be $77 for Black Friday. And at Target, you can get an LG 70-inch 4K smart TV for $550. That's a $300 markdown.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. A reminder, her piece on the holiday shopping season is available at DelawarePublic.org. And we have more to come on The Green, including our latest arts playlist, which highlights the latest art exhibition at the Historic Odessa Foundation. That's up next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Historic Odessa Foundation is offering its last art exhibition of the year. Oneness in Spirit, Art from the Artist Gallery in Chestertown, is at the Historic Odessa Visitors Center until December 30th. The Artist Gallery in Chestertown, Maryland, consists of 5 partners: Evie Baskin, Bonnie Howe, Mary Ellen Mabe, Nancy Thomas, and Barbara Zwilke. 3 of those artists, Nancy Thomas, Bonnie Howe, and Evie Baskin, joined Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist to discuss their work, including the 30 paintings currently at the Historic Odessa Foundation's exhibition. The conversation starts with Nancy Thomas.
Hey, since you're the first one I'm talking to, let's talk about Oneness in Spirit, Art from the Artist Gallery in Chestertown. What's the idea behind this?
The idea is that we, of course, are 5 different artists. We all have our own styles. We all have our own things that we like to paint, but we all are one in spirit. And Evie Baskin came up with the title, which we all agreed was a very good one, because we work very well together in and outside the gallery, and we all work very hard to produce beautiful art and keep the gallery going, which has been difficult during these hard times, but fortunately we're doing okay.
That's great news to hear. How did you get involved with art?
Well, I've been painting for a very long time, since the mid-70s, so that gives you an idea. I started in Northern Virginia. I was taking classes at a place called the Torpedo Factory in Alexandria, which is a well-known art center there in the Corcoran School of Art. Then I kind of went into a dance career for a while, but I started again in the mid-80s, taking art classes during the day, and I did get an associate in fine arts degree from Northern Virginia Community College, which had a very good art program at the time. And I met some artists, one from New York and one from the Washington area. Robert Chapman from New York was an assistant to Willem de Kooning. And Alan Gramley, his friend, lived in Potomac, Maryland, and I started painting with him, and he taught me how to paint in the style of the old masters with glazing. And I took a project study tour to Italy at the time, at the same time, and I took up watercolor because I didn't want to be dragging oil paints through the streets and carrying them on buses and whatever. So I started painting in watercolor, and then I started studying that with an artist named Judy Wingrovitz from Northern Virginia. And in 1994, I moved to the Eastern Shore, and I met an artist named Jean Rainey Smith. She's now deceased, but I studied with her for a long time, also in watercolor. But with the onset of plein air painting, I went back to oils. And since then, I've been working primarily in oils.
So since the group of you will be coming together on this exhibit, what can we expect from you when we go through the gallery?
Well, as I said, I have considerably large pieces. I have just old buildings and houses. So, and they're oils. They're all oils.
I want to move on to the other artist, but is there anything else that you think you want to mention, Nancy, that maybe Bonnie or Evie will not?
I just want to emphasize how well we work together and how what a wonderful place the Artist Gallery is. We get comments all the time when people come in there that it's such a peaceful place and it's so nice to come in there and so relaxing, because that's the mood we try to set there. And we work as one, because we each have our little chores. I make the labels for the walls, and somebody else and I take minutes for meetings, and each one has their own little job, and we just blend well together. It's a good group, and we're really delighted to be able to show in this group show at Odessa, because normally we just show together in our gallery and then we show separately other places, but we don't get the opportunity to show the five of us together very often outside of the gallery. So it's an opportunity that we're really grateful for, and we hope that people will come out and see it. I know it's difficult, but they're doing the social distancing and all that at the gallery, so it's a safe place to visit. It won't be very crowded, and I hope that people will come out and see our show.
All right, let's bring Bonnie Howell in. Bonnie is another part of this equation that is participating in this new exhibit, Oneness in Spirit, Art from the Artist Gallery in Chestertown. Bonnie, welcome. Thank you for taking time to do this.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Kelly.
Hey, before we get into your part in this exhibit, give me some background about the gallery in Chestertown.
Well, we have been here for nearly 20 years. The gallery was actually started in 1999 in Stevensville, but we moved in 2003 to Chestertown and have been here ever since as a partnership with five current partners. It originally had six, but we're all artists and have been painting most of our lives. We're not new to this in any way.
Why the collaboration now?
Well, it's good because we have a passion to paint, and most artists like to share what they create with others. And in order to do that, we needed a venue. And downtown Chestertown is a beautiful place, and it has grown in its art interests throughout the years, and it has proven to be just the right spot for us. I actually grew up in Chestertown, so I was glad to have the gallery here in Chestertown.
How did you get involved with not only the gallery, but with art?
Oh, well, I've always been interested in it. I was a fine art major in college and continued teaching, actually, art in my early career, and then ventured out into doing commercial work for quite a few years, illustrating. And then after my family was grown, my children were out of school, I decided to focus more on what I wanted to paint, and came into association with other fine artists through an organization in Easton, Maryland, called Working Artists Forum. And it's a group of professional painters that are encouraged through their association with each other. And it has really been beneficial because it put me in connection with quite a few other really fine artists. And so the cooperation has really been a good thing.
Bonnie, what is your contribution to this last art exhibit of the year from the Historic Odessa Foundation? It's called Oneness in Spirit, Art from the Artist Gallery in Chestertown. What are you bringing to the table?
Well, I primarily like to paint water in all of its various aspects, but primarily local water, our rivers and streams. Occasionally I do an ocean or two, which there is an oceanscape exhibited at this show. But I have a real passion for water, and it's always challenging to paint. So I hope the viewers will enjoy my take on it. I tend to look at it close up and personal.
How many paintings total will be in the exhibit?
I believe there are 30 paintings in the exhibit. We each have six. One thing that is good about us is that we all have different styles, where Nancy and I paint in oils, and occasionally Evie does. Evie primarily does pastel work. Barbara Zalke does watercolor, and Mary Ellen Mabe also paints in oils, but she is a plein air painter, as is Nancy as well. So they're all different mediums and have a great variety just in the style of artwork. And that is nice when you present an exhibit because it's, you know, it's not boring. There's a lot of variety that can interest a lot of different people. Yet they all hang nicely together. As if you get to see the exhibit, I hope you do. It it does have a oneness. It's a curious thing about how we are. Well, for one reason, we are all experienced, and we're about the same age, and we just have a camaraderie that I think is lovely. And perhaps Evie will mention that as well.
All right, just want to remind everybody, the Historic Odessa Foundation has announced the last art exhibit of the year. It's titled Oneness in Spirit, Art from the Artist Gallery in Chestertown. Chestertown is in Maryland. We've already heard from Nancy Thomas. We've heard from Bonnie Howell. And last but surely not least is Evie Baskin. Evie, thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for having us. It's also lovely. Thank you.
So Bonnie brought up a minute ago the fact that she and Nancy primarily paint in oil. You use pastels. Why? Can I ask why?
Good question. I studied art way back in Florida State University with a visual arts degree, and I painted in oil there. And when I came to Alexandria and moved up north from where I was going to school in Tallahassee, Florida, I moved to Alexandria, and I started doing a little bit more in oil. But it wasn't until I moved to Chestertown, Maryland, and I took my first pastel class with this brilliant artist in town called Mary Pritchard. And she taught several workshops, and I enjoyed each one. She took us out to paint in plein air, which was fantastic, and I hadn't done that either. And so it was just a real eye-opening experience for me. It's working with pure pigment. And as oil is a mixture of with solvents and different things, pastel is nothing but pigment on a stick.
That's one way to put it. Pigment. Yeah. She said pigment, folks. Pigment on a stick. Hey, talk to me, Evie, about some of your works in this exhibit.
Okay, I'm actually a very curious type person. So I like to work in pastel. I also like to do oil, and I also like to do silver point. But for this show, I had done a portrait of my dog, which is a labradoodle. And I had started experimenting with texture with her because she has this really curly top coat. And so I had painted underneath the pastel with acrylic paint to sort of raise the surface slightly to get that curl in there. And that worked out really well. So I thought, well, what else could I do? So I decided to experiment even more for this show. I've done an underpainting with using modeling paste first onto pastel board, let that dry, and then come back with a layer of pumice gel to make the pastel adhere. And so that would dry and then came back with the pastel on top of that. So I have done essentially six textured paintings for landscapes on the shore.
Thanks to Evie Baskin, Bonnie Howe, and Nancy Thomas from the Artists Gallery in Chestertown, Maryland, for joining our Kelly Steele on this edition of Arts Playlist. More information about Oneness in Spirit, art from the Artists Gallery in Chestertown, can be found at historicodessa.org. And we wrap up the green next with Enlighten Me, and more on what impact Joe Biden's post-election events on Wilmington's riverfront could have there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Wilmington Riverfront has spent decades trying to find its identity and build its viability. And while it has made strides in recent years, it still feels somewhat like a work in progress. But it has gotten an unlikely boost this year from Joe Biden. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, Biden was forced to accept the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in the parking lot outside the Chase Center on the riverfront. Then just 2 weeks ago, he celebrated becoming president-elect in that same spot. All of this helped put the Wilmington Riverfront, and specifically the Chase Center, on the national radar. But how much will it help solidify and grow its identity and viability? For this week's Enlighten Me, contributor John Hurdle seeks to answer that question in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to tell us what he learned. Well, I want to start specifically with the Chase Center on the riverfront itself. It, perhaps more than any other part of the riverfront, has really struggled to gain traction. It's looking to be a regional player as a convention center, but really to date, a lot of its business has been one-off events, weddings, graduations, and the like. What are some of the issues that the Chase Center has faced, especially during the pandemic, that has kind of made it hard for it to be what it wants to be?
Well, I think one of the problems that it has had is that until fairly recently, it has not had any available hotel space immediately around it. And so what I was hearing from a couple of the folks during the course of reporting this story is that in its early days, that is the convention center kind of opened as a full-service convention center in 2005, and it wasn't actually until 2014 that there was any hotel space actually on the riverfront there. And so, therefore, I think it was kind of a challenge to attract the kind of business that they wanted because convention attendees would be forced to stay elsewhere. But the Westin opened in 2014, and more recently we've had the opening of the Hyatt and Homewood Suites. And so attendees are much better, in a much better position to it's a lot more convenient for people to attend. The other thing to mention here is that the convention center is actually kind of limited in size in comparison with some of its nearby competitors. There's around about 90,000 square feet of meeting space in that building, but that's very much less than that in the Philadelphia Convention Center, for example. You mentioned the pandemic. The convention center was doing quite well. It had an 8% increase in gross sales in 2019, of course, was looking forward to further growth this year. But then the pandemic hit, and it was shut down along with many other businesses in March. Is now reopened, but with a maximum of 60% occupancy, and so it's going to be a kind of a slow ramp back up to full speed.
So I guess the good news for them is this attention that Joe Biden brought. I mean, certainly just watching his speech kind of declaring victory, I mean, the sign Chase Center on the riverfront was literally right behind his head in some of the wider shots. I mean, that's certainly got to be well-timed for the Chase Center to give it maybe some visibility it wouldn't have otherwise had. Does the Chase Center's leadership feel optimistic that attention and the work it did kind of handling all that Biden business, including the Democratic convention in the summer, will actually translate into new business?
Oh, yes, they're very optimistic that it will. there's a lot of use of this word visibility. I mean, this is, I mean, I spoke with Kurt Foreman at the Delaware Prosperity Partnership and Megan McGlinchey at the Riverfront Development Corporation, and they both said something to the effect that this is a terrific piece of visibility for the riverfront, for the Chase Center, and for Wilmington in general, that they couldn't possibly have bought if they'd sought to promote the development under the normal circumstances. As you said, the words Chase Center were on national TV screens for long periods of time over the election, and of course on November 7th when Joe Biden made his victory speech there. And so that is that's seen as really a huge boost.
And do they feel like they've also kind of maybe proven that they can handle that kind of work, you know, handling this kind of stuff, and a lot of it on the fly in a pandemic? I mean, I guess that's also kind of a selling point for them to say, like, hey, look, we could handle this.
Well, I was speaking to the communications person at the convention, Wilmington Convention Visitors Bureau, and she was very optimistic that the riverfront development in general and the Chase Center in particular, with those properties at the center of this very big national event, have proved that they can handle events, and they're optimistic that they're in a better position to promote themselves to other high profile events.
How about, you mentioned the hotels. How about the hotels and the other businesses around the Chase Center on the riverfront? Have they gotten a short-term Biden bounce?
Yes, they certainly have. I've been hearing from the Visitors Bureau that some of these that the hotels are full. There's of course been plenty of reporters around, political staff, and the restaurants are in better shape as well. Of course, speaking with one restaurant owner who said that he'd had a pretty much a catastrophic decline in business because of the pandemic, 80% down during COVID, but he was able to claw back some of that, at least over the election period.
So the big question then becomes is how likely is that to last beyond the next couple of months for the riverfront? Once things kind of die down and Joe Biden and his people move to Washington and Wilmington becomes less the epicenter of what's going on.
I say that they firmly expect that there is going to be a lasting benefit here, and they're part of the reasoning is that these events have put Wilmington and the riverfront and Delaware in general on the map, and so that's going to draw in more visitors. And one of the reasons for that, the interest is beyond the breaking news that you might see on CNN or whatever with Joe Biden and his officials making policy announcements, that the media interest has gone beyond those kinds of stories to more lifestyle stories. And so I was speaking with somebody from the Convention Visitors Bureau who said that, for example, Food and Wine magazine had just done a story about the places where the Bidens like to eat in Wilmington. And so that's part of the reason why they're very optimistic that this bounce is going to last longer than just the transition period.
And I guess the question is, you know, for Wilmington and Delaware as a whole, you know, does Biden's ascendancy to the presidency and the attention it brings kind of create a boom, you know, maybe not just in some of the areas you were talking about, tourism, but just in general in terms of economic development and other things? Is there a sense from the people you talk to that this could have kind of, you know, more tentacles to it in terms of what it brings to Delaware and the city of Wilmington?
Well, yes, and one of the points that was raised by the restaurant owner that I spoke to down on the riverfront was that, in his view, it's going to be harder now to make jokes about Delaware. He said, well, you know, that people might Gatsby might previously have kind of sniggered and made comments about Delaware and things like that. But that's no longer. It's going to be much harder to do that, in his view, given all of the national media attention on the state and on Wilmington in particular, and the fact that it's the president's hometown.
And I guess you also in the story mentioned that there's some thought that perhaps there's an economic development boost here, that maybe the state can draw other businesses and companies here, just again because people have a sense of who and where Delaware is. I guess, is there a sense that that's a possibility? Although I know there are some naysayers who are like, well, maybe not so fast.
Well, Kurt Foreman of the Delaware Prosperity Partnership, of course, was very cognizant of the high visibility that the state is getting as a result of this. Now, I mean, it's too early for that to have translated into any specific expressions of interest, at least as far as he was telling me about a week ago. But of course, he's optimistic that there will eventually be some economic benefits from this. On the other, you mentioned on the naysayers. I was speaking with Jim Butkowitz, an economist at the University of Delaware, and he's actually much less optimistic about this. And he said that first of all, people are not going to be coming to Delaware, however much positive publicity there is at the moment. COVID is going to stop people traveling. And by the time COVID restrictions are lifted, presumably at some point in 2021, Joe Biden will have moved, and his entourage will have moved off to Washington, D.C., and Delaware will no longer be the beneficiary of that. And I have to say that was kind of an outlying view amongst the folks I talked to, but then again, you've got to remember that this comes from a person who's the economist, are known to be coming from so-called gloomy profession.
I suppose a lot of this just kind of hinges on how much time Biden spends in his home state, either at his Wilmington home or his beach place. I guess, if it becomes, the new Mar-a-Lago, maybe there's a little bit more of a long-term bounce. If he winds up spending more time just in D.C., it's a different factor, I guess.
Well, indeed, and I was going to raise exactly the point about Mar-a-Lago. I mean, as everybody knows, President Trump spends a lot of time down there, and of course, all presidents come with an entourage of staff and political visitors, foreign leaders, journalists, and those, of course, and wherever the president is physically located, then of course those folks tend to it will draw those in, and so if Joe Biden treats Wilmington and Delaware if he spends as much time in Delaware as President Trump has done in at Mar-a-Lago, then that may support these optimistic scenarios of folks like the Convention and Visitors Bureau that this will be more than just a flash in the pan, a brief surge surrounding the election.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for enlightening us this week. His piece on the impact Joe Biden's election events on the Wilmington Riverfront may have there is available at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Eileen Dalabrida, John Hurdle, and Larry Nagengast. And Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. The Green is taking a break next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.